I think it's important to learn eschatology. We should all study eschatology. That's a good thing. But the thing with Revelation is it's difficult to nail anything down here. Why is that? Why is Revelation so difficult to understand? Well, we'll dive right in into the first Revelation chapter 1. Yeah, is it okay? It's okay. It's solid red. That's correct. Okay. All right. Revelation chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. These three verses introduce the book, and they tell us what we're reading, what kind of book we're reading. It's the revelation, right? It's a revelation. What is a revelation? A revelation is a revealing of things that are otherwise concealed. So it's the revelation of concealed things that God granted to his son, Yeshua, Jesus, so that he in turn could deliver these concealed things to his angel, it says, who could then in turn deliver these concealed things to John, who could deliver them to the servants of the Messiah so that they could obtain a preview of things that must take place. So notice the chain of transmission. You have a transmission of information from God to Messiah, from Messiah to his angel, from his angel to John the apostle, from John the apostle to the Messiah's servants. That's how it's going down. And then it says, blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. And this is, you know, this is a blessing, a beatitude statement, an ashrei. Happy is the person who reads this. So this tells us that this revelation was meant to be read aloud in the assembly. It's meant to be heard. And there's a blessing both for the reader and for the hearer, and finally for the one who keeps it. So what is the revelation? Well, obviously it's the visions that follow in the remainder of the book. But we could also translate the word revelation as the apocalypse, right? Apocalypse, because the Greek word that we're translating as revelation is the Greek word apokalypsis, which means unveiling. That's what it means. It's ordinarily the word apocalypse, you know, it invokes in our minds images of global cataclysm. But the Greek word apokalypsis means unveiling, uncovering, the revealing of something previously concealed. And so that's when we say the revelation of Yeshua the Messiah. It's the apokalypsis, the uncovering, the unveiling. Because revelation is simultaneously, you know, it's this unveiling, this revealing of whatever it's going to reveal. You know, the thing is, I find it interesting that everybody has a theory on Revelation. You know, when I said I was going to start teaching Revelation, I suddenly started receiving emails with people trying to school me on it. You know, like they're going to tell, they want it, like from my own congregation, they're like trying to like get in their interpretation there quick before before they lose control of the situation. You know, so It's like the most studied and least understood book of the Bible, I think. You know, modern readers like ourselves, we find it very difficult to understand the symbolism and it's packed, really jam-packed with allusions, not illusions, but allusions to Old Testament texts, to Old Testament prophecies, to the point where if you're not like really well-versed in the prophets, in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament, it's nearly unintelligible. And much of the book is locked up in thick symbolism, which we no longer have the keys to unlock. In the days of the apostles, however, apocalyptic literature like this was popular and well-read among the believers. So the first century reader, the first century believer didn't find the symbolism of the book of Revelation nearly as obscure as we do today. And that's who John was writing for. The book was written for people who lived 1800 years ago. 1900 years ago. And another thing, the book of Revelation is not the only apocalypse in the Bible. We're going to find that, I'm going to show you just a couple examples, that the Bible contains several of these unveilings, these unveiling moments, so to speak, in which a prophet or a seer is shown mysteries of the heavens and spiritual things that are at work behind the scenes. Jewish literature from the apostolic era had a lot of apocalypses. I mean, we can speak of it as a genre. You know what I mean when I say a genre of literature? I mean, for example, I used this example last night. Suppose that you took two different books. One is a detective novel. If you like to read detective novels, you pretty much know what you're getting into when you read a detective novel. The other, maybe a dictionary, right? Now, as you approach these two books, if you open the dictionary, or you open the detective novel, you're not going to be able to like look up the meaning of a particular word necessarily, right? This is not in a way a detective novel works. It's a different, it's a completely different kind of book, right? You open up the dictionary, you're reading through the dictionary, and you're just like, man, I just don't know where this thing's going. You know? I don't see how this is. Right? So, I mean, those are extreme examples of different kinds of, you know, really within literature when we're talking about different kinds of genre. Oh, okay, so maybe we could say, I could contrast, like the book of Psalms is very different from reading the book of Matthew, right? You know, Matthew has a narrative, and the Psalms is all poetry. Those are different genres. Okay, Revelation also falls into a genre. What kind of genre is it? It's a genre that we call apocalypse. Because we named the genre after the book of Revelation. That's why it's called apocalypse. But what makes something an apocalypse? We have all sorts of apocalypses. You know, as I decided to study the book of Revelation and to start teaching the book of Revelation, I spent the summer at my home congregation of Beth Emmanuel Sabbath Fellowship in beautiful historic Hudson, Wisconsin. www.bethemmanuel.org. I spent the summer Sabbath afternoons with a couple friends sitting around in the afternoons speed reading through apocalypses to just try to immerse into the language of apocalypse. And so there we're reading, you know, the apocalypse. You can read these titles, the apocalypse of Baruch, you can read like the apocalypse of Adam, the apocalypse of Elijah, the apocalypse of Ezra, the apocalypse of Noah, the apocalypse of Enoch. And then titles like Hekalot Rabbati, you know, these strange, you know, which could better be titled the apocalypse of Rabbi Ishmael, you know, strange works of Jewish mysticism from the first century and the second century and from before the days of the apostles. So what is it that makes something an apocalypse? These are not books in the Bible. They're like the deep cuts, the B-sides of the Bible that didn't make the final cut, I guess. You know, they didn't make the canon. But what is it that makes an apocalypse an apocalypse? That's what I want to establish with you in this first talk. So an apocalypse, to be an apocalypse, it usually begins with the protagonist who's writing in the first person, who has some sort of ascension, some sort of vision, some sort of dream, some sort of translation or spiritual experience in which he sees stuff and then he writes down what he saw. He says, I saw this, I saw that, I saw the other thing. And so that's the first thing. First common element of an apocalypse. An apocalypse always involves some sort of unveiling in which a human being usually retells his experience in the first person, this experience that he had in a mystical vision or trance or some type of ascension. And he describes the vision of something he saw, usually of the heavens. So, for example, the classic example, of course, is the book of Enoch. First Enoch, Second Enoch. Maybe you've not heard of these. Again, these are books that were around in the days of the apostles. Enoch, you're familiar with from the book of Genesis. Enoch walked with God, and then he was not because God took him. Genesis 5:24, right? Well, where did God take him? Everybody wants to know. Everybody wanted to know. So, we filled in the gaps with somebody at some point wrote the book of Enoch to tell us the rest of the story. You know, I'm not saying that it's legitimately written by Enoch or anything like that, but I do know that you know, the apostles read this, Jesus read this, the book of Enoch. We find references to it all through the New Testament. The fact that Yeshua refers to himself as the Son of Man, that comes from the book of Enoch, also from Daniel, but primarily from the book of Enoch is where we see that expressly as a title for Messiah. Hebrews 11:5 tells us, by faith Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had taken him up. You could say that Enoch is sort of the father of Jewish mysticism. I mean, people wanted to know about this story. So we ended up with this apocalypse of Enoch, in which Enoch is taken up to the heavens. The angels give him a tour of the place. He gets to look around. He gets to see all sorts of otherwise unseen things. He gets to see the seven heavens, the throne of glory. He gets to hear heavenly worship services. He gets a tour of all the heavenly chambers. That's where God keeps the snow. That's where God keeps the hail. He gets to see the spiritual places where there's, the souls of the righteous, the souls of the wicked. The souls of righteous are receiving their reward, and the souls of the wicked are receiving their comeuppance. And then he gets to see a war between the forces of good and evil, and this war plays out in the field of human events, and then at the end, a final judgment. That's an apocalypse, and so these are the kind of common elements. It starts with an ascension, a translation, a vision, a dream, or something like this, like Enoch had, and then usually there's an angelic tour guide to show you around. And he, takes you around and says, look at this, look at that. Do you know what that is? No, I don't. And then he tells you what it is. And so you get a third thing would be a tour of heaven. So number one, an ascension. Number two, an angelic tour guide who gives you a number three, a tour, right? And, this happens to people apparently. It's never happened to me. But apparently it happens. Paul, for example. You know this story about Paul? Paul says it this way. He says, I know a man in Messiah who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. Now, we know that Paul's talking about himself here when he says this. And he says, and I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. That's the apocalypse of Paul right there. He was told not to write it down, unlike John, who was told, write it down. This is one of the rewards of faith, apparently, that occasionally, that once in a while, there is a lifting of the veil when the unseen world becomes seen, when things that are only hoped for become substantial. And it doesn't happen to everyone. I don't know why. And it doesn't happen the same way when it does happen. And not everyone, not every one of us is a mystic that has these sorts of experiences. But once in a while, you might have an experience with God. It might be a small thing. It might be a brief revelation, a personal experience of some sort or another, a small moment when you come to that place where you know that you know what you saw, right? You know what you heard. It's a quick subjective encounter with the supernatural. Or, alternatively, maybe you have a full-on apocalypse. The big thing. Like what Paul experienced, or what the prophets experienced. Like Isaiah has an apocalypse. He says, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. Surrounded by the cherubim, chanting, holy, holy, holy. The train of his robe filled the tent. That's an apocalypse that Isaiah is telling us about. And then you might get the tour. You might get the tours. And while you're getting the tour, it's not at all uncommon for the seer to witness the heavenly worship services like Isaiah was doing there. So you're getting the tour, you get to hear the angels, you get to hear the liturgy, you get to hear the worship of the King. Because an apocalypse wants to show the mortal that although things on earth seem terribly unjust, the righteous are suffering and God's people are being persecuted and the wicked are prospering and whatnot, a day is yet coming when God will reveal his wrath against the wicked and the righteous will be rewarded. But you don't need to be afraid because God is still on the throne. That's the message of an apocalypse. And in an apocalypse, we see that in the future, God is going to intervene in human affairs and serve justice. He's going to reward the righteous and punish the wicked. So here's, I'm giving you the elements. These are like the basic elements you can expect to find in a piece of literature that we would identify as apocalyptic. Number one, some kind of ascension. Number two, angelic tour guides. Number three, a tour. Number four, heavenly worship services of some sort, or a vision of God on the throne, something like this. Number five, a future in which God intervenes on earth and serves up justice. That's a theme that's consistent. Because an apocalypse wants to show us that God is sovereign and that He will ultimately intervene, perhaps in a catastrophic manner, to set the world aright and to save His people. Powerful forces of evil oppose Him, and we see those in an apocalypse. But in the final culmination of things, He defeats His enemies. And then the sixth thing that I find to be a common element in apocalypses is the use of symbolic language to describe this vision, to describe this experience. An apocalypse is describing spiritual things for which we have no capacity to explain. I mean, how do you explain a color that you've never seen? Or how do you, if you hear a sound that you've never, no human ear has heard before, how do you tell your neighbor what it sounded like? You know, nobody's heard this. Nobody's seen this. So an apocalypse, the writer of the apocalypse is left to rely upon highly symbolic language to communicate this experience. And often so we find mythical beasts and representing the forces of evil and world empires and flocks of sheep allegorically representing God's people. A sword represents judgment and so forth. And we see this kind of language, for example, in the book of Daniel, which arguably is the first of the apocalyptic genre. Well, I already told you Isaiah had an apocalypse, but I mean the first that really explores this genre is the book of Daniel. And this symbolism is more than just literary devices, more than just ornamentation. Instead, it's meant for us to puzzle over it and to ponder it and to wonder over it. That's the idea. It's supposed to be a little cryptic. You know, it's supposed to make us say, now what does this mean? Finally, a typical apocalypse offers its readers some word of encouragement, a word of hope. The seer in the apocalypse encourages the faithful to remain faithful. Because despite the calamity of your current circumstances, through the unveiling, the person sees that one day the righteous are going to be rewarded. One day the wicked are going to be punished, and everything that is amiss is going to be set aright. And that's what an apocalypse is. These seven things. Ascension, angelic tour guides, tours of heaven, heavenly worship services, God intervening and serving up justice, heavy use of symbolic language to convey this vision, and then the final message, hope and encouragement for the faithful to remain faithful despite their circumstances. If you get that much out of the book of Revelation, you got it. That's really all you need to know about the book of Revelation. To understand the book of Revelation. Wasn't that easy? Now what do you want to talk about? Here's what an apocalypse is not. An apocalypse is not and does not function as a crystal ball to predict the future. It just doesn't work that way. It's not meant to do that. An apocalypse is not a description of current events. So, you know, if you take the newspaper and you read in the newspaper and say, oh my goodness, look what's happening over there in Syria. And then you take the book of Revelation and it's like, well, you know, it's not meant to do that. An apocalypse is not a sequence or chart of end times events. You can't, they don't work that way at all. They aren't meant to convey any sort of first this, then that, then the other thing type approach to eschatology. Instead, an apocalypse is more like you take all these different pieces of eschatology and you put them in a hopper and shake them up and then dump them out into someone's head and see what it's like. All right, so an apocalypse is not a literal narrative. They're not meant to be taken in the literal, and especially when we're talking about the symbolism and so forth. We're not, you know, a lot of the apocalypses portray Israel as a flock of sheep. You know, well, clearly we're not talking about real sheep here. We're talking about God's people presented as a, so it's not literal, but neither really is it allegorical. Well, it is, the symbolism is, the symbolism has some sort of value. We can interpret the symbolism. But it's not allegorical in this sense. You know, the church around the second century decided to make Revelation allegorical and say, well, I know it talks about a literal return of Jesus to the earth and it talks about him setting up the Jewish kingdom and that sort of thing, but that's not what it means. It's really talking about the church, you know, and so it makes it an allegory to try to strip away the actual value of the message, which is that there is a kingdom coming, that the messianic era is still coming. That's literal. Don't let anyone tell you that's just an allegory. That's the whole message of the gospel. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. So, why is it so hard to understand? Why is it so hard for us to understand? I'm just going to give a few reasons why we find it difficult to understand an apocalypse. Why, you know, like Revelation. Any apocalypse, but specifically Revelation. First of all, well, like I said, it's an apocalypse. They're supposed to be hard to understand. But second, and we're not familiar with the genre because we only have the one, you know? We only have the book of Revelation. We need to be more familiar with the whole genre. It's like if you were to read one detective novel, and then you assume that's the only detective novel, right? But if you read the rest of the detective novels, at least the ones in the same series, you learn quite a bit more about, you know, the whole genre and the way it works, and you know what to expect, and you know where this is going. And so if you're not familiar with the genre of the piece of literature that you're reading, yes, it's going to be difficult from the outset. Okay, so that's one reason we find it difficult, because it's a genre with which we are not familiar. Okay, second, because it's written to first century believers. It's specifically addressed to the believers living in Asia Minor under John's apostolate in the 90s. And I don't mean the 1990s. I mean the 90s. So whatever other interpretations and meanings that we might derive from the book of Revelation, we have to remember that the message of the book was originally intended for Jewish and Gentile disciples of Yeshua living in Asia Minor in the last decade of the first century. Therefore, if the interpretation of Revelation that we derive strays from something that would have been readily apparent and comprehensible to those believers in John's congregations, well, that's an interpretation we should treat with extreme suspicion then. It doesn't make sense that the book wouldn't make sense to them, but does make sense to us. Okay, so this is another reason, because it's difficult to understand for us because we live 1,800 years later. 1,900 years later. Anyway, also, it's a Jewish book. This is a big thing. I mean, this pretty much applies to the whole New Testament, but it's a Jewish book, and you know, so the modern Christian reader finds the book of Revelation difficult if he or she is unfamiliar with the Jewish background to its symbolism. It's and because it's drawing imagery from not only from the prophets and their prophecies in the Tanakh, but also imagery that's derived from the temple, from the priestly worship, from Jewish tradition, from Jewish liturgical ceremonies, from synagogue tradition, from Jewish eschatology. All these ideas saturate the book. I mean, you're reading these themes from the high holidays and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are littered through the book. They appear in the form of things like shofar blasts and doors standing open in heaven and people in white garments, right? People dressed in white garments. I mean, if you do the Jewish festivals, these things should be, you know, clicking with you. The call to repent before the final judgment, the books of judgment being opened, a book of life, you know, a book of life and the other books. The book of death and the multitude around the throne with the palm branches in their hands. This is Sukkot stuff. Now we're talking about Sukkot, you know, and it's recreating the temple worship from the festival of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. So Revelation transposes several ceremonial and liturgical functions from the temple to the heavenly temple. Why? Because the temple on earth is supposed to be a reflection of the temple above, right? We learn that in the book of Hebrews. We learn that in the book of Exodus. We learn that in the Midrash. We learn that in Jewish tradition, that God said to Moses, he said, have them make a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. Make it according to the pattern of everything you see up here during this apocalypse that I'm giving you on Mount Sinai, as I'm giving you a tour around the place. I see this lamp. I'm really fond of this lamp. I'm going to need one of those down there. You know, like that. The temple on earth is supposed to reflect the heavenly temple. All right, so another reason that we find we find it difficult is because modern readers look to the book of Revelation like it's supposed to be some sort of manual to the end times. And like I said, Apocalypse doesn't work that way. It doesn't present a sequential description of end times events. Instead, here's the thing. An Apocalypse, written by Jewish people for an assumed Jewish readership, is assuming that its Jewish readership is already familiar with Jewish eschatology and messianic eschatology, already familiar with how the end times are supposed to go down, which was largely an oral tradition in the first century, but should already be familiar with how these and so the Apocalypse is, you know, it touches on these things. It grabs a piece here. But the Revelation is simply adapting the broad strokes of the existing system of Jewish end times expectations in order to present this vision from behind the veil. So that's the genre. That's why it's difficult to understand. Now I'm going to give you a really quick overview of the book. Okay? This is your crash course. The book begins with the vision of the risen Messiah commissioning his apostle John to record the visions that he has seen and the things which are and the things which will take place after this. And he says it this way. This is really amazing to me. In verse 19 of the first chapter, he says, "Therefore, write the things which you have seen." Notice that's in the past tense. Things you have seen. "And things which are," that's present tense, "and things which will take place after these things," that's future tense. So this statement covers the range of history that I believe is addressed in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation, in my interpretation of it, presents a spinning kaleidoscope of visions from the past, visions of the present, and visions of the future, which explains why much of the content of the book seems to pertain to the era of Nero and the Jewish War, so the 70s. And much of it seems to pertain to the era of Emperor Domitian and the persecution under Emperor Domitian, so the 90s. And much of it seems to pertain to the end of days, the last days before the kingdom, the final tribulations. This past, present, future focus of Revelation then corresponds to a larger liturgical theme of the book, where it says, "Holy, holy, holy," the angels chant, "the Lord God Almighty, who was, who is, and who is to come." who was, past tense, who is, present tense, 95, common era, something like that, who is to come, future tense. Our master intended the vision, he addressed the vision of the revelation primarily for believers in Asia Minor who were suffering under a new wave of Roman persecution that we're going to learn about tonight. And he gives John messages for seven assemblies under his apostolate: Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And these messages rebuke the assemblies for their failings, praise them for their successes, but mostly encourage them to stand fast in the face of persecution. Then a voice speaks to John and says, come up here. And he ascends to the heavenly places, gets a tour, he gets to see the throne, he sees the Lamb surrounded by angelic worship, he sees a scroll with seven seals. It's unrolled, and with the breaking of each seal, a vision of judgment on the earth unfolds. Similarly, angels sound seven trumpets. Each trumpet brings a vision of judgment. Seven angels then pour out seven bowls. And each one brings some calamity or plague on the earth. Further judgments fall upon the woman who rides upon the beast. That is, the woman who rides the beast. This is Rome. She's the city that sits on seven hills. It's quite explicit in the text. The beast is the seven heads of the beast. The woman's sits on seven hills. This is the woman who rides the beast. She's drunk with the blood of the martyrs. She's drunk with the blood of the saints. John records the vision of Israel, depicted as a pregnant woman, a heavenly woman bringing forth a son. Who's the son that Israel brings forth? This is the Messiah. Israel is opposed by a dragon. Who's the dragon? It tells us right in the text. This is Satan. But the dragon that Satan is occupying, is possessing, is the Roman Empire. And so then we see the dragon comes and attempts to snatch the child away, but the child is taken up to escape the dragon. And then the dragon turns to persecute the woman, to chase the woman. This is the first century we're seeing here. And a great deal of the ensuing imagery revolves then around the spiritual identity of the Roman Empire and the Caesars. And John sees a bestiary of monsters, depicting Roman emperors all empowered by Satan with their multiple heads as one emperor replaces another. And then he sees the Lamb on Mount Zion with his followers. And a great contest ensues. The beast, that is Caesar, demands worship and allegiance of all the people on earth, those holding fast to the Torah of God and the testimony of Yeshua, refuse to worship the beast, and so they pay the price of martyrdom. The book concludes with a vision for the final battle of Jerusalem, the coming of Messiah, the Messianic era, the resurrection of the dead, the new heavens and the new earth, New Jerusalem coming down, the world to come, the hope of persecuted believers. So in the days of the apostles, you had people who would seek this kind of experience. Mystics, visionaries, who would seek out revelations and apocalypses. They undertook rigorous 7-day fasts, and in some cases 40-day fasts, and through ritual purifications and fasting and prayer, they would seek to achieve states of altered consciousness, which might allow them to glimpse into the heavenly realms. People did this, and Jewish mysticism to this very day warns people, don't try this at home. In fact, Jewish the rabbis said you shouldn't even be reading apocalypses. I mean, they're not on the kosher reading list anymore. But in terms of seeking the experience, the Talmud tells us about some who experienced too much, went too high, too far, too soon, like Elisha ben Avuya, who, based on the visions he saw, he lost his faith because what he saw didn't fit his strict definition of monotheism. He saw a second beside the throne. Or like Simon, son of Zoma, who was never the same. He lost his mind after his apocalypse. And Paul warns us about people who are always claiming to have apocalypses. You know this verse from Colossians 2:18, he says, "Let no one disqualify you, no one who's insisting on asceticism and the worship of angels." This sounds like this asceticism, worship of angels, this is starting to sound like this stuff. "Going on in detail about visions, puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind." So be warned of apocalypses, trying to achieve apocalypses. But on some level, I think we're all trying to achieve an apocalypse. Some revelation, some unveiling of the spiritual world. That's what the life of faith is really all about, isn't it? The mystic, the man of faith, the woman of faith, doesn't just want to learn about God or study about God, know about God, but actually to be swept up with the unseen, caught up with the divine. Whether in the body, out of the body, I don't know. But to know God rather than just to know about God. The book of Revelation offers us that opportunity. That's the real reason for studying the book of Revelation. It's not going to tell us much about modern events, I don't think, in Iraq, Syria, or the political aspirations of Vladimir Putin, or conflicts with Iran and the Iran nuclear deal, or Barack Obama and ISIS, or things like this. But I believe it will offer us a glimpse into the unseen world behind the thin veneer that we call reality. This is the revelation of things concealed which God gave to his son Yeshua, who entrusted it to his angel, who revealed it to John, who transmitted it to us. In the words of the book of Revelation, we can ascend like Enoch, like Elijah, like Paul, like John, along with John, to those heavenly places where the Son of Man is seated at the right hand of glory. And we can experience vicariously his divine amazement, the divine amazement of mortal flesh in the midst of the world of immortality, among myriad angels and the souls of the righteous made perfect. And from that high and lofty vantage point, we can look back down upon the world of men and thereby better understand our own world and all that befalls us. And in this way, the book of Revelation offers us hope for us, even today, even in our personal situations, whatever they may be, our personal trials and tribulations. Hope for us, even until the end of the age. And this is Ashrei. How glad is the one who reads, and how glad are those who hear the words of the prophecy and who heed the things which are written in this book, for the end is near. But before we get started, that's all in the way of introduction. Before we get started on the revelation tonight, I want to read you just a few of these apocalyptic encounters, okay? From outside of the Bible. Let's go outside the Bible for a little bit. Just for a little bit. I'm just going to read maybe three of them, and then we'll take a break, okay? We'll take a break. Just so you can kind of get, because I've been talking about this whole genre of literature that you just have to take it for granted that it exists, you know? But now I'm going to bring you inside a few of them, okay? Turn in your Bibles to the Apocalypse of Ezra. Oh, I gotcha. There's no Apocalypse of Ezra in your Bibles. But I'm going to read to you from a document that was around in the second century, called the Apocalypse of Ezra. It opens this way: "The word and revelation of Ezra, the holy prophet and beloved of God. It came to pass in the 30th year, on the 22nd of the month, I was in my house and I cried out and I said to the Most High, 'Lord, give the glory in order that I may see your mysteries.' And when it was night, there came an angel, Michael the archangel, and says to me, O prophet Ezra, refrain from bread for 70 weeks. And I fasted as he told me. That's a long time. And then there came Raphael, the commander of the host, and he gave me a storax staff. I don't know what a storax staff is, but that sounds pretty cool. And so I fasted twice, 60 weeks. And then I saw the mysteries of God and his angels. And that's how the apocalypse of Ezra begins. And you know, it goes on for quite a ways. Ezra enters this state of altered consciousness through fasting. He sees angels, and the angels reveal mysteries to him. You got an apocalypse. Okay, here's another one. This is from the apocalypse of 3rd Baruch. Baruch is, of course, the scribe that worked with Jeremiah. He was Jeremiah's scribe. So, allegedly, theoretically, this is, you know, pseudepigraphically, this is the 3rd apocalypse of Baruch. He says, truly, I, Baruch, was weeping in my mind and sorrowing on account of the people. Notice how he says that. I, Baruch. So you know who he's talking about. I, using the first person, Baruch. You know who he's talking about. I was sorrowing on account of my people because Nebuchadnezzar the king was permitted by God to destroy his city, saying, and I was saying, Lord, why did you set on fire your vineyard and lay it waste? Why did you do this? We find that apocalypses cluster around national tragedy. Because when national tragedy occurs, like the destruction of the temple, the people of God are left saying, why? And the apocalypse comes to try to answer. Why, Lord, did you not requite us with another chastisement? Why did you deliver us to nations such as these so that they reproach us now and say, where is their God? And behold, as I was weeping and saying such things, I saw an angel of the Lord coming and saying to me, understand, O man, greatly beloved, and do not trouble yourself so greatly concerning the salvation of Jerusalem. For thus says the Lord God Almighty. For he sent me before you to make known to you and to show to you all the things of God. For your prayer was heard before him. It has entered into the ears of the Lord. And then he said these things to me, and I was silent, and the angel said to me, cease to provoke God, and I will show you other mysteries greater than these. So Baruch here is fasting and praying after the destruction of Jerusalem. He enters a, presumably, an altered state of consciousness through fasting and praying. He sees angels. The angels reveal mysteries. They reveal other mysteries. You got an apocalypse. Okay, here's another. This will be the last one that I read to you. From outside the Bible. Okay. This is 2nd Enoch. Not 1st Enoch, but 2nd Enoch. On the first day of the first month, I was in my house alone and was resting on my couch and slept. And when I was asleep, great distress came into my heart, and I was weeping with my eyes in sleep. I could not understand what this distress was or what would happen to me. And there appeared to me two men, exceedingly large, so that I never saw such on earth. Their faces were shining like the sun. Their eyes, too, were like a burning light, and from their lips was fire coming forth with clothing and singing of various kinds. Singing, that doesn't make sense to me. Of various kinds, in appearance purple. Their wings were brighter than gold. Their hands whiter than snow. They were standing at the head of my couch, and they began to call me by name. So I arose from my sleep and saw clearly those two men standing in front of me, and I saluted them and was seized with fear. And the appearance of my face was changed from terror. And those men said to me, have courage, Enoch. Do not fear. The eternal God sent us to you. And behold, today you shall ascend with us into heaven. And you shall tell your sons. And so on, and it goes on. And so there you go. Enoch's sleeping. He's in some sort of altered state of consciousness. He's weeping in his sleep. Suddenly, angels appear to him. Apparently, these angels are frightening to behold. Faces shining like the sun. Eyes burning bright. Fire coming out of their mouths. Terrifying. Dressed in purple. They come, they take Enoch up, and they reveal to him mysteries. That's 2nd Enoch. Right. So those, these are, I just wanted you to see a little sample of this world of Jewish literature from the days of the apostles. But we don't have to look outside the Bible to find this kind of material, do we? Because we have the book of Daniel. When we come back after the break, I have to show you a few things in the book of Daniel before we jump into Revelation. Okay? Okay, so we're going to take a break because I could keep talking for hours, and you know, but I want you to get up and use the bathroom and stretch and that sort of thing.